Welcome to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, where we discuss the big issues confronting animal welfare and the environment. My guest today is well-known actor and passionate animal advocate, Peter Egan. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Philip. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. Peter, where did your love of animals begin? How did that happen?
Well, I think like all human animals, my love of animals started when I was a child. I was brought up in an all-Irish household in North London. My father's family, my grandmother and grandfather, five aunts and three uncles, came over to the UK in 1936 when there was a huge migration into England from Ireland around the Depression, and there was no work. And they all settled in one house in North London. And it turned out there were 13 human animals in this one house on three floors with a derelict basement and no bathroom, one loo. We had a bath in the kitchen. And the other members of this extraordinary household were two dogs. One was a black and white collie, and the other was a chocolate brown retriever. And I remember them possibly more vividly than I do the humans in that household. And my brother and I and my cousin Declan, we had a terrific friendship with these dogs. And I think, like all kids with dogs, you learn about your first, the meaning of friendship, because dogs are there for you and they want to play with you. They are always very pleased to see you. The reason why I have dogs now, dogs are great for actors. They're always welcoming and they always listen to you. So I think that was my first introduction. And that's something which I think is very important. I think that all children have compassion and that kind of feeling for animals educated out of them. When you are in school, you have hamsters and things in cages and rabbits in cages and fish in bowls and stuff like that. And you visit zoos and you start to develop very, very early that the human relationship with an animal is that of ownership and also of control. So I say that apropos the fact that I then kind of forgot about that relationship I had with the two dogs for, I think, probably up until I was 40. That was because I was very ambitious and working very hard at being a successful actor. And I regret that very much because I wish I'd introduced dogs and cats into our lives when our daughter was much younger. But I left it until I was 40, when I'd kind of got to a point in my career where I felt I could control my time in the workplace more. But even during that period of time, I was very much an owner of a pet. You know, I hadn't developed into that wonderful area, creative area of compassion, where we are all equal. So I was still relating to my pet, although I thought I loved crackers, as my pet dog. That dog had to do what it was told. And then a few years later, we were living in West London, in Chiswick at the time. My wife was out shopping, and she suddenly found this blonde Labrador lying in the street. And so she got someone to help her and put the dog in the car to the local vet, which is 100 yards away, and then came home and said, I've found a dog today and I've taken it to the vet. And I said, oh, that's very nice of you, that's great. And she said, it's coming home tomorrow. I said, what do you mean it's coming home tomorrow? And she said, well, it's an abandoned dog. And I said, well, we've already got a dog. We can't have two dogs, can we? And so anyway, this blonde Labrador who had obviously been in a home, because it was very home friendly. It was house trained, but it had been living on the streets for a long time. And in fact, the vet said he's very lucky because you found him at the right time, because his kidneys were about to give out. He'd been eating lots of rubbish and hideously underweight. Anyway, so the dog moved in. Then I started to see dogs relating to each other and relating to us as well. And And we also had two cats, and that was also very interesting. I learned, just in terms of animal behaviour, how dominant cats are as far as dogs are concerned. So I was kind of picking up the individual characteristics and differences that I hadn't been aware of at all as far as animals are concerned, because I think, like a lot of people, I just viewed animals as animals and not as individuals. Walking on the heath, I kind of got to meet a lot of people walking their dogs, and I started to find out, just by talking to various owners, about the whole business of dog rescue and what was happening with dogs in London and in the inner cities. Things I'd never considered, and I think lots of people don't consider to this day, the amount of dogs that are abandoned in a great city like London. And, of course, the amount of small charities, that, small rescues that are peppered all over the place, as well as the big ones, that the big established ones like we'd all know, you know. And so I suddenly was getting... Suddenly my relationship with Crackers was introducing me to a new world, another world that I didn't know about, just purely by walking him in a very dog-populated area. One thing I had picked up on was that he was very social and liked an animal community around him and liked being with the cats and the other dogs. So we decided that we would rescue. First time we would ever... We rescued Custard purely by accident, a social rescue, if you like, but the process of rescue I had no knowledge of. So someone said, well, you should go and visit. There was the National Animal Welfare Trust in Watford. So I went, and I amazed. I suddenly go to this place, and there's 200 dogs, and there's pigs, and there's... Because, you know, they were a multi-species rescue.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is a whole world going on here I don't know anything about. So suddenly we became friends, my wife and I, with the person who was running this place. And I said, where do these dogs come from? She said, they're abandoned or they're whatever, you know. So you learn, you know, another thing, you know, because again, I do think even now that people are not aware of the problem. You know, I know that the Dogs Trust coined that wonderful phrase, a dog isn't just for Christmas.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the best
catchphrases.
Clarissa Baldwin. Clarissa Baldwin, exactly.
Yeah, dog is for life,
not just for Christmas. Exactly. Yeah. So all of these things started kind of crowding in on me and becoming aware of just how many animals were abandoned. I found myself thinking, you abandon human beings, you abandon dogs, you know, and then, of course, many human beings are abandoned, of course, as we know. But I was there looking at lots of dogs, someone said, you wanted a Labrador, and I said, yeah, we wanted a Labrador because those were the only dogs we really knew. And so they came out with this blonde Labrador, and the blonde Labrador had hazel eyes, not dark eyes like a lot of Labradors. And I said, oh, he's got funny eyes. And as I said it, I thought, what are you talking about? He's got funny eyes. And I suddenly realized I was pretty stereotypical. You know, I wasn't the kind of person that looked at an animal in a dimensioned way. I looked at it in a kind of way of, is it what I expected? This sounds so trite, but, you know, I was being trite. And that caught me short. And we rescued that. We took that dog. That was Sam. And we had Sam for 15 years. He was wonderful.
Some of the most moving moments at events where you and I have been to is when you take out of your pocket a poem.
Yes.
Called Just a Dog.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which...
Yeah. It's a mantra of mine, yes.
And it sounds like... you've absorbed that poem and the meaning, yes, through your own experience.
Totally, for example,
we were at the University of Winchester when, yes, they launched their Centre for Animal, yeah, Welfare. I think you also read it at the Eurogroup for Animals.
I did.
And
yeah,
this is, tell me about how you came across that poem and what it means for you.
Well, I came across the poem by accident. I was sort of just looking at dog things and dog sayings, and I spent a lot of time on the computer picking up dog references, and I just found the poem. And I read it, and I thought, I could have written this, because it's everything that I wasn't when I first had a dog, but it's everything I became because of the experience of being with those animals. And right. So I understood everything that that poem was saying. But just to finish this off, sorry, my gatekeeper was another rescue, which is a dog called DJ that I also rescued from the National Animal Welfare Trust. And DJ was a Spaniel Collie cross. And we called him DJ because he had a white bib and a black coat, and it looked like he was wearing a dinner jacket. So my wife said, why don't we call him DJ? And which is what we did. And DJ was a remarkable dog, because like lots of Spaniels, he would sit, and when listening to you, he'd turn his head to one side, and it had that wonderful kind of...
Beautiful. What is
that? It's that sort of Princess Diana moment, isn't it, of kind of doughy-eyed sort of concentration. And I can never, ever mention DJ for too long without getting very moved, because he was so important to my life. But the other dogs brought me to the gate, and DJ opened the gate. And it was to do with the fact that coming home after rehearsal or filming or whatever, and your wife becomes so used to you coming home that she isn't necessarily interested in the day in the way that you possibly want her to be, but DJ always was. So I used to sit and chat to DJ, and I found myself looking in his eyes and thinking, there's more to this than meets the eye. And it sounds possibly fanciful, but I looked at DJ and I saw all animals. He introduced me to a magnificent world of animals, and so I attribute my complete dedication and compassion that I feel for every species on this planet, I dedicate that to DJ, really.
And so you would root your interest in farm animals through your companionship with DJ.
Indeed, totally, yeah. Yeah, he really kind of said, look, there's more to me than meets the eye. There's more to animals than meets the eye. And I hadn't locked into farm animals, of course, at that point, because I was eating them at that time. If I'm perfectly honest, farm animals were a commodity. They were a food source. They were something that were part of the celebration of the Sunday lunch, you know, that kind of habit. And I hate using the word like tradition or culture, but that's what it is, tradition without necessarily being culture. I always believe the word culture should be attached to something creative rather than something destructive. I can't ever associate eating a roast, Sunday roast, as being cultural, but it is traditional.
And you've become vegan.
I am vegan
since.
Now, yeah.
Yeah. What was it that turned you vegan, and how did you find it?
Well, I was becoming obsessed with animals. I was suddenly finding all animals interesting, and I think that did start me questioning, I eat animals, would I eat DJ? Again, he was the big question master there, as far as that.
He was the lens,
absolutely, yeah. Totally. DJ had been in my life from 1999 until 2015.
Right.
He was 16 years.
Yeah.
I gave up eating meat in 2009.
And vegan... 2016?
Vegan about 5 years, but officially maybe 4 years ago.
Okay.
About 5 years.
Yeah.
I'd given up everything. I hadn't come out as a vegan in the way that I did after. I was asked by Veganuary if I would, you know, just give it a push and declare that I was doing Veganuary. I think it was in 2015 or something. But I was almost there anyway. What opened the door into that journey was 10 years ago watching the film Earthlings.
What was the effect it had on you whilst you were watching it?
I thought I was watching a horror story. I thought I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe the amount of destruction I was watching, and the carelessness, and how any human being could treat an animal in the way that the animals were being treated in that film. Just for a sandwich, or for a Sunday roast, or just for the momentary, I know it's a cliche, but for that momentary mouth pleasure, to destroy an animal for that, it was heartbreak. At the end of it, I finished the film, and I was sitting in our kitchen, and my wife came in, and I couldn't speak, and she said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "I just watched the most devastating thing in my life," and she thought I'd had a stroke. I could hardly speak, and I couldn't speak for 3 hours after watching it, and that changed my life. And I had said to myself, "I'm not going to contribute to this kind of slaughter, this cruelty, and I'm never going to eat meat again." And I never have since that day to this. And it was the biggest shock of my life, I think, watching that film.
And how did you channel that horror and quite possibly anger into something positive?
It's interesting you use the word anger, and I'm sure you know this better than I. You can be angry about it, but anger is not a very good engine. Compassion is the best engine. It's the most powerful engine. And you can shift through hurt and anger if you embrace the horror into compassion. I think compassion helps you understand the horror. And the great result of responding to that horror is compassion. I think compassion is the strongest element in all of us, much stronger than hate. So, first of all, how did I do it? I started to kind of just research the whole thing of... this is in relation to how did I channel it.
Yes.
I mean, because it wasn't long after... I think I first met you when you came up with Joyce De Silva and we had a coffee in Chiswick. It's about 6 years ago, wasn't it? There was a couple of years I was arcing to that point, where I just wanted to find out why we felt we could treat animals in the way that we do. Deciding not to eat them gave me a whole new perspective on their rights rather than their welfare.
Yeah.
It also defined me to vision, if you like, in being someone who is animal rights as opposed to someone who is animal welfare. And although I believe one has to go with the other, you can't have welfare without rights. And I know that people have a very frightening image of animal rights people as being balaclavaed and bomb-throwing and all that. And most of them that I've met aren't. They're just... to use the word again, deeply compassionate people who understand you can't have human welfare without human rights, you can't have animal welfare without animal rights. So, again, that's as a result of your question, what happened after watching the film? So I just started learning about farming practices. Choosing to be a vegan meant the first thing I had to do was start label reading, so, you know, and I didn't become a vegan immediately. I just stopped eating meat to begin. But I was a pescatarian, I suppose. And I was also eating cheese, and I was drinking milk, things like that, because I hadn't... Cheese and chocolate were the last things that I gave up, because they seem to be so innocuous. You know, chocolate's delicious, and milk, everyone tells us we've got to drink it, because it's good for us. And again, milk tastes nice, you know. So,
and we were brought up with it at school.
Indeed,
there was free milk.
Free milk, absolutely.
As a child.
Every morning. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, what could be wrong with it?
What could be wrong with it? Yeah, absolutely. What could be wrong with it? Well, little did we know. We learned so much about what is wrong with it from many of the things that you and Compassion in Farming have taught us.
And did you know at that stage about so many animals being kept for a lifetime in cages, for example, laying hens in battery cages, pigs in crates where they can't turn around, things like that.
No, I mean, I just absorbed the horrors of the slaughter in earthlings, but the journey, no, I didn't kind of put that together. I think a lot of that came about after first meeting you and being introduced to Compassion in World Farming, and then learning more about the work that you were doing, and the fact that these horrible situations exist, and that I had been contributing to it, you know, for the greater part of my life.
And since then, really, you've been an ambassador for change.
You've been a huge
help to us with our End the Cage Age campaign.
Marvellous. So delighted to be a help. I mean, so many things fell into place for me and have fallen into place to me from the moment I chose to give up eating meat. And then when someone said to me, well, why are you eating fish? I mean, fish have a life as well. What are you going to go against fish? I said, I've got nothing. I like fish. I like, you know, you said, you like the taste of fish. And of course, yes, sadly, that was true. So I then sort of looked into fish and, you know, is it true? I don't know. I hope it is true. People say, you know, lobsters mate for life, you know, and stuff like that.
And in terms of how you view animals and how that has changed, and particularly choosing not to eat them. Has that caused you any interesting moments in your acting career? Because you've had a very long and successful acting career, Ever-Decreasing Circles, of course, Downton Abbey, and more recently, Unforgotten, and so on. Have there been moments where you've been filming eating scenes?
Yes, I mean, since I became vegan, part of my contract is that they provide me with vegan food. But what is wonderful about that is that in the last 5 years particularly, every location caterer that is imaginative and good at their job always has a vegan option on the menu. And I just love that. And they have vegan snacks and things like that. If I'm supposed to be eating what is meat, it'll be mushrooms made to look like meat, you know. So
we noticed this in Unforgotten.
We were
looking at it, going, great, you know.
Peter's influenced the
meal choice here.
Indeed, absolutely. So those things. And also, what is interesting about that is that a lot of the time now, I mean, and this happened when I was at the National Theatre, and they have a big canteen at the National Theatre, and they again would provide vegetarian and then a vegan option. The vegan options are so simple, you know, because all you're doing is cutting out one element. And I would find myself sitting down with my colleagues in the canteen, and those that had meat on their plate used to apologize. And they'd sit down and they'd say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm eating a steak. I said, thank you for apologizing. I said, but apologize to the person you're eating on the plate. That's who you should apologize, not to me, because they died for you to eat that.
Mm.
So I try not to be too pompous about it, but I can't resist the giving, you know, a voice to the animal. So yes, it's now become, it's quite, I'm not the only one, you know. Martin Shaw, for instance, when he was doing his series Judge John Deed, he insisted that the catering be all vegan.
Fantastic.
This is way before I became a vegan.
Martin Shaw, of course, is another compassion supporter.
Oh, is he? Great, marvellous.
Yeah, particularly on live exports, he did a lot for us on that issue, which,
fantastic,
of course, you're very active on as well.
Yeah.
You were with us recently in Hyde Park.
Indeed, absolutely. Wonderful event, yes.
With Theresa Villiers, who is the new Secretary of State
indeed.
At DEFRA.
Fantastic.
So we hope that she will use her position.
Well, indeed, it's very good is that there are a lot of animal... can you call MPs animal activists? I mean, Zach, for instance.
Animal friends.
That's good. Animal friends. Yeah, there's a lot in government now who are animal friends, which I think it's very clever as well as committed, because what Parliament has learned in the last 10 years, and I think this is one of the great effects of social media, is how powerful the animal vote is and how important to them as human beings it is to be seen to be supporting animal issues. Their status rises a bit, I think, with that. They become more human, which is wonderful. And the more we care, that's precisely what happens to us, isn't it?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that in this time of environmental decline, of climate change, you're seeing the fact that being cruel to animals actually degrades the environment and erodes our future.
Indeed, is
a critical joining of the dots.
Indeed. And also the terrible now accepted journey that those who are cruel to animals generally have been or are going to be cruel to humans.
Exactly.
And also that kind of societal link that certainly I've found that this is very evident. I've been doing a lot of work in terms of strays in Eastern Europe, in Bosnia.
Romania,
very recently Romania, and Bosnia, and that very positively the link is becoming more and more shared and aware that those children who witness cruelty to animals are also witnessing domestic cruelty at home and also go on to become people who practice domestic cruelty themselves. And so that link has got to be cut.
Exactly.
So that they have a chance of being more dimension themselves. And I say then, we break the link and we have a greater chance of being less violent ourselves.
Thinking about that big picture association, animal cruelty, environmental degradation, the whole climate chaos, what's your greatest fear?
My greatest fear, it's the stupidity of human beings colluding with their own destruction, and not being aware that they are colluding, because people think, what's wrong with my steak sandwich or my hamburger or my chicken nuggets, or what's wrong with the fact that I eat meat 3 times a day? Because I like it, and it's produced, and it's, and I help commerce, I help the world go round, because I am buying food and it's taxes. I'm contributing as well as enjoying what I want to eat, without actually understanding that by eating the amount of flesh that they eat of all kinds, they are taking so many of the resources out of the planet that they are going to drain the planet dry, for want of a better image, and the planet will be no more. So my greatest fear is that human stupidity would actually bring about human annihilation.
And given the animal cruelty that we both see in the world, particularly to farm animals, but also to companion animals, lab animals and all sorts, what gives you hope?
It's interesting you should ask that, because I was talking to Jane Goodall about this on Friday night. I said, do you see an upward curve in this, or is it going slightly up, or is it straight? And she said, no, I can see the curve going up. And I said, why? And she said, because of all the young people that I come in touch with who understand the destructiveness by not contributing to industrialized farming. They want a better planet, and they are understanding our planet. They understand it through her roots and shoots. And even the RSPCA is starting compassionate classrooms, things like that. I do think all of the young people I meet, and I meet a lot of young people, I mean, when we had the event in Hyde Park, lots and lots of young people there, very, very articulate. Bella Lack is a good example, a wonderful, wonderful speaker. Well, she's 15 or something, isn't she? I mean, has huge following on that peer group inspiration is, I find, inspiring. That, I mean, and it's a cliche, but they are the future. And I do think that one with the great power of social media, when it's used creatively, it gives me great hope for the future. At 15, I wasn't talking about the planet. I mean, I had many other things on my mind, but it wasn't the planet. Maybe it wasn't as crucial when I was 15, but it certainly is now. And I do think the message is getting out, and I think the message is being received, and the fact that the message is being received gives me hope.
Thinking about compassion supporters and their focus on factory farming and ending live exports, what would you say to them to keep them motivated?
I would ask them, what do you feel is the most important thing in your life to yourself, and how you wish to lead your life? Do you wish to lead a life that is engaged with freedom and love, or do you wish to lead a life that is related or engaged with oppression and restriction. You want to live a life where you can look out of the window and see things grow, see a variety of plants grow, see a variety of birds flying in the sky, be aware of the incredible life that's there that we can't see. Do you want to be a part of that, or do you want to see it concreted over?
And what's next for you in your acting side of things?
Well, next I'm going to do another series of Unforgotten. And
excellent. That's our family favourite.
Oh, good. I think it's...
And Love Unforgotten.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It's a great series, beautifully written. And another series of Hold the Sunset starts with a thing I did with John Cleese. That was something which I really loved doing. I had a lovely St. Bernard to act with in that.
You were a dog walker a number
exactly,
of times.
Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah. I'm more than happy to accept jobs now if I have a dog with me, and it's an added attraction. And it was also great to work with John Cleese, a legend. I mean, he's been someone I've admired all my life, so that was a great treat as well. Yeah. So, it's really rather nice at my age as well. I mean, I've been at it for 53 years, and for people to still want to employ me, I think is terrific. I'm really thrilled about that.
Well, Peter, I think it's fantastic that you're able to use your profile to bring to the public's attention what's going on for animals.
Well, that's, I think, very aptly put. I mean, I design my life now as an actor. Really, it has to work into the work I want to do as an animal advocate. That comes first for me now, and is the most rewarding. But if I could just put in one other thing, because it's a species that is very rarely touched upon, and they are very, very important to me, and I adore them, and that's moon bears.
Indeed.
So when I'd finished the first season of doing Downton Abbey, it was the first time I went to China and went to Animals Asia's sanctuary, moon bear sanctuary in Chengdu. That was another life-changing experience for me to see. And this is another thing, part of the conversation we haven't touched on, which is vivisection and the use of animals in medical experiments and creating faux medicines, which is another life-changing thing for me. I think that it's very, very important that not only that we change our diet in terms of not killing animals, that we also accept that testing on animals, modelling them for human diseases, is a total waste of time.
So Downton Abbey really has helped you
hugely,
to help
yeah.
animals.
Oh, it has helped me enormously as far as... it is a door-opener, yeah. When the Times of China heard that a Downton Abbey actor was there visiting, they rang up and did an interview. So it's because Downton is hugely popular in China. So that was also a wonderful gift, to be able to kind of make a contribution to raising the awareness about the moon bear problem.
Peter, thank you so much for sharing your journey, for telling us about DJ and Crackers and all of your other companions that have been on your life journey with you, for telling us about what animals meant to you, mean to you, are to you and to us, and for sharing your thoughts of hope. And thank you for being our patron.
Well, I'm delighted, I'm thrilled. I've learned so much from Compassion in World Farming and from your books, from Farm Again and from the Dead Zone, they're marvellous books.
Thank you.